radioalburn.com.
Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 10th of January 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live tonight at radioalbion.com, because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise, back from his trip to Never Neverland. Deep in slumber, I believe you were last week.
You couldn't have said that introduction last week, could you?
No. I stuck here all of my lonesome. What happened, Dennis?
Well, it was, to be honest, I'm still not out of the frame of mind of Christmas festivities, even now. And so at the height of it last week, I lost track of what days they were. This is God's honest truth. And so while you were frantically trying to get in touch with me, I was kind of sleeping off a bit of a heavy drinking session.
And when did you realise?
Yes, I can.
When did you realise, Dennis, that you'd missed the podcast?
Well, this is the gospel truth again. The next day, I asked the wife, what day is it? Thinking it was Monday. And she said, no, it's Saturday. And then the awful dawning was that I'd missed Friday.
you'd missed more than Friday if you thought it was Monday and it was Saturday.
But the important one was Friday.
4 or 5 days, I think, possibly gone missing there. Well, you're here now, at least. That's good.
Certainly am, yeah.
So you had a good Christmas then, by the sounds of it.
I had a very good Christmas, yeah. You know, Christmas is one of my highlights of the year, always has been.
And have you been working at all, or looking at producing anything else, or have you just been taking a break for the week?
Well, I haven't actually been working on anything. I've got a certain idea on a... What I really want to do now is not really concentrate on the 6.5 hour documentaries, which are, believe it or not, a task in itself, but I wouldn't mind doing the odd hour or hour and a half, just as a, you know, mainstream documentary would do.
Are you looking at maybe doing something shorter, or a sort of hour-long film, basically? Is that what you're wanting to do?
Yeah, well, it's just the fact that there was so much information to get out there to people that they actually went to 6.5 hours quite comfortably, you know, but whereas really, you know, I want to do something which is a little bit more impactful and shorter to get some of the messages home.
What is there that you'd really sort of like to concentrate on more then?
I knew you were going to ask that question.
Yeah.
Well, the one in question at the moment it's the one that's forefront in my mind at the moment is one on Churchill. Because although there's a lot said about the man in various parts of the world and different views, there's no real documentary which covers all the facts. And, you know, I think I can do that quite comfortably within 90 minutes.
That's a really good point. That I think that's a very good idea that you got there, Dennis, and very timely as well. I mean, a lot of people still see Churchill as a bit of a hero, but in actual fact, he lost us the empire, and he didn't just lose us the empire. He destroyed half of Europe and basically put in place the system we have now.
Sorry, I saw this, the new, she took taken over from Juncker in the EU, and she was giving a marvellous speech about how Britain was and how they should really go to extreme lengths to get a good deal for this Brexit. And then she happened to mention Churchill, and she actually said, and it was true what she said, that he was one of the proponents of this EU in Europe, which goes against everything national he ever said.
Did he win a Kalergi Prize? Did he win a Kalergi Prize, a Charlemagne Prize?
Yeah, and I went on one website and they thought it was a mistake. This couldn't have happened, but it did, and there was a reason why it did. And he's highly regarded in the EU community.
And when he started,
go on. I
was
just going to say, he always spoke with a forked tongue, and the one shining example I used was when he said that this war will, you know, be the saving of Christianity. What he really meant was we've sided with the communists, us as America, and we're going to wipe Christianity off the map.
This is a strange thing, isn't it? You know, because if you look at early Churchill, and he talks about Bolshevism. He talks about Bolshevism being 100% Jewish. He talks about Islam. He talks about the threat of Islam. And then he got himself into debt, heavily in debt. And then this Blenheim Palace. And then the focus group bailed him out. And the focus group, a large portion of the people involved in that were Jews. There were also Gentiles. But it was a very pro-Jewish organization. They bailed him out. And after that, he was beholden to them, basically. They paid for everything. So he did what they wanted, I think. Up to that point, he was... you know, he did make some good quotes. And even after the war, he was still talking about the white race, and the white race needs to keep itself away from the non-white races, otherwise it would get blended out. And he was anti-immigration. But I guess, you know, all the people were back then.
Well, like I said, he did speak with a forked tongue, so I have to take a lot of that with a pinch of salt, because actions really speak louder than words. And I emphasised in the final episode of Communism by the Back Door, his funeral, which showed the people of London coming out, and the cranes on the you know, the shores of the Thames all dropping in salute, or raising in salute, should I say, and not one immigrant in this particular crowd. And but if they would have known 50 years later that his policies with the EU and by defeating Germany come to fruition, that London would no longer be an English city.
Oh, the people back then would be horrified to see the country now. Absolutely horrified. Yeah. Think that they gave their lives, their friends gave their lives, their brothers, their cousins, so many people died during that war, and they were told that they needed to go to war to prevent a foreign country from colonizing us. And at least that foreign country was another European country, and it wasn't true. But now you've got whole parts of the country that don't even speak English, with road signs written in Urdu and Punjabi and Bengalese and all these different languages. And they're no-go areas for the British people. I mean, they would be horrified to think that, you know, they gave their lives and they were told it was for freedom and democracy. You can't have democracy if you're going to censor people's opinions. You know, I've just been thinking about this recently, Dennis. You know, the whole point of democracy is, you know, you get to hear what everybody has to say, and then you make your mind up about what you want to go along with, what you think sounds the most truthful. And you know, that can work. That's democracy. If it's done properly, it can work. We don't have that because we censor people's opinions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like I have been on Facebook this week, they now have the technology that if anybody happens to write the initials of the documentary, the first one, or even, you know, the full title, or even Dennis Wise, then if you're in Messenger on Facebook, immediately you get slammed with a threat and a possible ban of 30 days because they feel that the content is not, you know, to their liking. But when you obviously see the things I've revealed and how the Allies admitted to killing babies and old men and women down in Austria after the war had finished and the soldiers had surrendered, then I'm not surprised they really want it banning.
Well, what is the wording that they use there? Do they say you're a hate group, or do they say for targeting immigrants?
Offensive.
Because I was going to say, I don't see how you could be accused of inciting hatred or inciting violence, because I mean, what you do is you provide a different view of history. You provide the other side's view of history, which is what democracy is all about.
Yeah, I agree, but it would be still hidden today, I believe, because I used to think I'd drawn the short straw of a few, you know, maybe. But when I look at it, when I look back at my childhood and what I was taught and when I grew up and was able to do videos like I did, I don't think there's that many in the queue who could possibly do it anyway.
Yeah, well, you don't have an option of not doing it. You know,
I did. I could have stayed quiet.
Yeah, well, that's no option. That's no option.
Exactly.
That would be dishonest to yourself and dishonest to your ancestors and dishonest to the world. You know, if you know that there's an injustice, it's up to you to point that injustice out. You know, that's what the documentary does.
Yeah, but the people who don't want the injustice pointed out obviously ban it and don't want people to see it. And as I mentioned a few weeks ago, ADL, since 2013, refused to discuss it. They've just blanked it out because they knew any discussion would bring attention to it. And once attention comes to it, people start seeing a different picture.
All it is just telling the other side, isn't it? You know, there's two sides in a war, and we've never been told why the other side really went to war. What was it like from their side? We're not allowed to hear that, obviously. I mean, that just shows, doesn't it?
We're just told, look at these neo-Nazis, these skinheads, they've got tattoos of the swastika on the skull, and these people represent Nazis. And, you know, the intelligent person, not that intelligent really, can understand that the Nazis were just ordinary people. You know, shopkeepers, people who go to Asda, who just look like us. You know, swastikas on the foreheads and tattoos on the face. But that's been projected, and that's the image that people have.
And there must have been a reason why people supported Adolf Hitler. I mean, they'll tell us today, he just went mad and suddenly started killing all these Jews. I mean, why would people go along with killing Jews? You know, either it didn't happen or the Jews must have done something. I mean, we're told, they make it out today that Jews were just innocent victims. They were belligerents in that war. A lot of them were fighting on the side of the partisans. They declared war on Germany a long time before war started. Judea declares war on Germany, or organized Jewry unites against Germany. And if you look at the way that the Japanese were treated in America, they were put into camps. Germans in Britain, they were put into camps. And once war broke out, obviously, if you've got an enemy nation that's in your country, you need to secure them so that they can't sabotage things. You know, they were enemy belligerents, the same as any other nation that was at war with Germany. And yet they're made out to be these completely innocent victims. And that should just be common sense to people, that they shouldn't be seen as being different to anybody else. And we don't even know the numbers of the Europeans that died in that war or the British people that died in that war. And yet we have this magic number of 6 million Jews that no less than 6 million Jews died in that war. We've no evidence for it.
Well, it showed in the documentary, and again, I'm just showing what was hidden, was the fact that, you know, from well before the century, this 6 million figure kept cropping up all the way through back in 1920, 1919, you know, all the way right up to World War II. So this 6 million myth, so to speak, has been pushed ever since the turn of the century. And it didn't just appear after the war, World War II. So again, people are looking at that and thinking, well, this can't be right.
And then they go looking to try and find out this information, and they can't find it anywhere. The only places they will find it is in the alternative media.
Yeah.
You know, and they'll find it in documentaries like yours, the Europa, The Last Battle, Hellstorm, and things like that, and alternative books, and was it the Barnes Review in America, publishers, Carolyn Jaeger, and all these alternative sites are the only people that are actually giving this alternative view, the other side of the story.
It can't all be lies, can it? You know what I mean?
No, well, you know, if it was lies, I don't think they'd be trying to censor it. They'd be quite happy for it to be there. And if you look at the people that are trying to say that Hitler was a secret Jew, Hitler was a secret Zionist, they don't get censored.
No,
their channels are still up.
Pagan or whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's true. You know, at the end of the day, like we said right at the end of all my documentaries, I said, you know, I insist people research themselves. I'm just showing them what I have found following a train of thought that I was taught when I was a young boy. And I've stuck to that all the way through, as we know on this podcast. And for weeks, I said in the Secret Masonic Victory of World War II that I felt I was getting close to something, but I know it's there, but I just can't find it. And because it's hidden deep, most people wouldn't look where I was looking until eventually the walls came tumbling down with the revelation of Hitler's Pope, which they admitted that the Vatican was behind Hitler coming to power. So it wasn't something I made up. Now, they've since denied it, but they were always going to deny it. So, you know, I mean, it's just hidden history.
Well, it's fairly recent history as well for them to be trying to, you know, for them to try to cover it up and hide it. I mean, it's only 70 years ago. You know, there are still people alive today that remember what went on, that are scratching their heads when they see the stuff that's on the television.
The secret weapon they have is the control of the media, because, you know, there must be plenty of people like myself finding these things, and then they try and get it out there, but it's just no match for when the whole media is pushing the other side, you know, whether in America or whether in Britain or in Europe, they control that mainstream media. The mainstream media only ran aground with the election in America with Trump and Clinton, because it was getting so obvious.
Well, it's been exposed since then, hasn't it? I think more and more people are distrusting them and starting to question what it is, you know, they've been taught. That's why they're so desperate to censor everything on the internet and censor all these alternative voices. But, you know, they can't put the lid back on it. You know, once the horse has bolted, you know, you can't close the door. And that's what the internet's done. It has been an instrument of real democracy, because people have been able to get their voices out. They have been able to get their stories heard, and people all over the world are waking up to the truth of these things and the truth in history, and using it as inspiration for shaping their future. And that's why you have to know the truth about history. Well, you have to know the mistakes your people have made.
Well, like you said, you know, in true democracy, you would have the choice to believe whatever. And I know for a fact that people who've got in touch with me in numerous numbers have said, you know, this makes more sense than the other version. Now, I understand why such a thing happened and such a thing didn't happen, because I was just telling them the other side.
Yeah, it's very important to hear both sides of the story and make your own mind up. And we're going to be looking at something which is fairly topical today with what's been happening in Iran. Now, in one of your episodes of the documentary series, and also in one of these podcasts, we talked a little bit about the National Socialists and the relationship they had with Iran. Do you remember it was one of your episodes of the documentary series, wasn't it?
Yeah, the final episode. Now, I had heard previously, I'd seen a YouTube video, which I've probably mentioned in the past, where West Germany were playing Iran. This is before, obviously, East Germany, well, the wall came down. So this is before then. And the German travellers to Iran to watch the game were stunned to see the Iranian supporters standing and giving the Roman salute to the German national anthem. And this was captured on a YouTube video, which it took me aback myself. So I looked into it, and then I realized that they were classed as Aryans. Didn't really go much further than that, but just thought when Merkel came out and said, we will back Israel against any war with Iran, they were going against their own principles of nature. So that aside, it wasn't until I saw this clip for the final part, which said, you know, that in 1936, the racial laws didn't extend to Iran for certain reasons. And I can remember discussing it with you, and obviously the first you'd heard. And so obviously you've looked into it a lot more since then. And it is an interesting tale.
Yeah, we got more information on that now, some more detail on it. But going back to that football match when they were doing the Roman salute, they see that as the Persian salute, because they think that the Roman salute came from the Persian one, which is like the armies raised up a little bit higher, and they say that the Romans took it on from there. And this animosity towards Iran, I mean, I think it probably does go back to the Second World War. It's not about not so much about this Islamic Republic, but it was their relationship with the National Socialists, because they were very, very tight with them. And then after the war, there was also Egypt and Syria, and we'll talk about them a little bit later on. Yeah. But the main one was Iran, and they helped them build the railways. They helped them built up lots and lots of infrastructure, and were on really good terms with them because they saw the Iranians, or the Persians at the time, as being like cousins, as it were. Because if you look back 2,000 years, 3,000 years, you have Parthians, you have Medes, and you have Persians, and they're all basically became the Iranians of today. And but unfortunately, they also became intermixed with Arabs. And other non-whites to varying degrees. Some of them have a lot of European genetics, a lot of white genetics, and others of them are a little bit darker. But they still retain a lot of the culture that they had before that happened, the pre-Islamification culture of Zoroastrianism. And that's why the Muslims don't like them, because they have a different brand of Islam that allows music and allows images and has respect for their early culture. They're not like ISIS. They don't want to destroy all their heritage and say it's idolatry. You know, they're quite proud of the fact that at one time there was this big Persian Empire, and it had wars with the Roman Empire, and they were a very, very powerful empire, basically. The Parthians, the Medes, and the Persians. So the Germans saw them as being distant cousins, basically, because of this. And also they saw that area as being one of the homelands of the Aryan people, the Indo-Aryans, which was the European peoples, but basically spread out from Europe and into Persia and into India. And this was while Europe didn't even have a proper civilization, because they didn't have so many people there. We didn't need to. You know, we were in areas like Persia and in areas like India and in areas like the Fertile Crescent, where the temperature is a lot better, where it's a lot easier to grow crops. We had no reason to spread out as far as we could go to the west into the icy wastes. We had these empires in the temperate zones. So that was the first places where the Aryans spread out from. And it was because of this that Germany had this big link with Persia, so much of a link that they got them to change the name from Persia to Iran. As you brought up in your documentary series, Dennis. But I actually found some more information on this. On a Wikipedia page, actually, about race. It wasn't specifically about Iran, but it is quite detailed. It says, beginning in 1933, the National Socialist leadership in Germany made efforts to increase their influence in Iran, and they financed and managed a racist journal, Irani Bastan, co-edited by a pro-Nazi Iranian, Sheikh Abdul Rahman Saif. This and other chauvinistic publications in the 1930s were popular among Iranian elites. They highlighted the past and the pre-Islamic glories of the Persian nation and blamed the supposedly savage Arabs and Turks for the backwardness of Iran. So that's the first bit of it. So they had a nationalist movement in Iran, and the National Socialists were funding an Iranian journal that was pointing out racial truths, basically, that Arabs and Turks, you know, they were savage. I mean, nobody can say that the Arabs weren't savage. Just look at what they did in Bulgaria. And look at what the Turks did to the Armenians and the Christians in Turkey. I mean, they were savage. So, and it was basically, you know, they liked the idea of this national socialism, and they had a nationalist movement amongst them. And I don't know if this magazine was anything like Der Stürmer. I don't think it was. It could have been. Could have been. I don't know if they had that much of a problem with the Jews, though, in Iran. I think I did read a while back that Iran has the second largest number of Jews, second only to Israel, in the world. But they don't,
I think it's when Soviet Union and Britain invaded Iran, you know, during World War II, it's the Ashkenazi side of it, of the elites in Russia and in England.
So you think it's the Sephardic. So you think the Jews in Iran are the Sephardic type?
I think so, yeah. I think the influence of invading Iran to stop them aligning with Germany or whatever was coming from the elites of England and of the Soviet Union, who are, of course, Ashkenazi.
And it was very important to them as well, because the Germans were hoping to get relief from Persia. Basically, once they'd made their way through Russia, they wanted to get relief from Persia, and the Allies went into Iran to prevent that from happening. And they also actually toppled the Iranian leader because he was so sympathetic to National Socialism. I've got another quote here. The Nazis found a favourable climate amongst the Iranian elite to spread fascistic and racist propaganda. The Nazi propaganda machine advocated the common Aryan ancestry of the two nations. In order to further cultivate racist tendencies, in 1936 the Reich cabinet issued a special decree exempting Iranians from the restrictions of the Nuremberg racial laws on the grounds that they were pure-blooded Aryans. In various pro-Nazi publications, lectures, speeches, and ceremonies, parallels were drawn among Reza Shah, Hitler, and Mussolini to emphasize the charismatic resemblance among these leaders. Now, what it doesn't tell you there is that that was to do with the Olympics. And and what the Iranians were concerned about was that they would be classed in the same class as the Jews because they were Semites. They were like Arabs. That's what this bit about them saying that they were pure-blooded Aryans and they're exempt from this decree. Because you remember I pointed out before that, you know, they wouldn't have been encouraged to breed with the Germans. What it was is that they didn't want to be classed the same as the Jews and the Turks, which, you know,
they're
not like them. I mean, if you look at them, as I say, they've got quite a high proportion of European blood, much more than the Qataris or the Saudi Arabians or the Turks.
The actual fact that Britain allied with the Soviet Union to invade Iran kind of blows Churchill's, you know, thoughts on Christianity completely out of the water.
Well, Churchill's alliance with Stalin is just complete hypocrisy, isn't it? They don't forget they declared war against Germany because Germany went into Poland and Stalin went into Poland 2 weeks later.
Yeah, and look what happened to him.
Yeah, and 2 years later, they're allied with him. Yep. And his best buddy, Stalin. Roosevelt was the one that was really liked Stalin, I think. Yep. He was calling him Uncle Joe and putting out all this propaganda of what a wonderful person Stalin was. And that was... that was before they actually came in to the war, if I'm right.
Yeah, he was trying to get him into the League of Nations, which he did succeed, but then I think he got kicked out again for some atrocity.
Wouldn't surprise me. And continuing with these quotes here, Nazi ideology was most common among Persian officials, elites, and intellectuals. But even some members of non-Persian groups were eager to identify themselves with the Nazis and a supposed Aryan race. Hitler declared Iran to be an Aryan state. The changing of Persia's international name to Iran in 1935 was done by the Shah at the suggestion of the German ambassador to Iran as an act of Aryan solidarity. Now, it's interesting that they're still called Iran to this day.
Mm. You know, tried to turn it back, I believe, but it didn't get through.
Well, it shows you there's a lot of support for it.
Mm-hmm.
They're proud of their Aryan heritage.
That's right.
And they want to make a point of that. And again, this shows you know, it wasn't boot boys and thugs that were international socialism. It was the officials, the elites, and the intellectuals.
Yeah.
And of course, members of non-Persian groups wanted to identify themselves with these people because they were a successful people. And if you look at Iran today, they are... you know, the most technologically advanced out of all of those Arab states. You know, they do everything for themselves. The Saudis might have the most money, yep, but they have to bring Europeans in to do everything. And the same with the Qataris. They have to bring Europeans in. Iran's done everything for itself.
Yeah, they've even got the scientists assassinated as well. Mossad, I believe, were part of that. You know, I mean, they are what you would call an intelligent race.
It's a huge land that they have there as well. Absolutely massive, the land that Iran has. And they did have, these different Persian tribes, basically, and they were trying to unite them all under this pan-Iranianism, pan-Aryanism, which was basically these different Persian tribes all identifying as Iranian. And it wasn't like it is today, where it's like a theocracy and Islam is right at the forefront of everything. They wore quite Western clothes. And at one time, the burqa was outlawed. And basically, they were looking to Germany and thinking, well, this is what we want to be like, and we don't want to be caught up in this banking system as well. This was a big part of it. So the Allies were not happy with Iran. As you say, they went in there at the end of the war, but that wasn't it. They also stirred up a revolution and got rid of the prime minister later on, which we'll hear about here when we get to it. In 1936, the Nazi Office of Racial Politics, and of course, when I say that word, it's just because that's the word that Wikipedia uses, the National Socialist Office of Racial Politics, in response to a question from the German Foreign Ministry, classified non-Jewish Turks as Europeans, but left unanswered the question of how to think about the obviously non-European Arabs, Persians, and Muslims. Later in the year, ahead of the Summer Olympic Games in Berlin, the National Socialists responded to questions from the Egyptians by saying that the Nuremberg racial laws did not apply to them. And after the Iranian ambassador to Berlin assured German officials that there was no doubt that the Iranian is an Aryan, was racially kindred with the Germans, the German Foreign Ministry assured the Iranian embassy in Berlin that the correct distinction was not between Aryans and non-Aryans, but rather between persons of German and related blood, on the one hand, and Jews as well as racially alien, on the other. So the splitting people into two different camps there. But obviously not saying that they could interbreed together, but just saying that there are people that are closer to the Europeans and there are people that are further away from Europeans. And if you were to look at Negroes and Aborigines, you would say that they're the furthest away biologically from Caucasians as it's possible to get. And the closer you get to the Caucasian, the Persians are probably the closest that we actually get to us. I mean, I can't think of anybody else that's closer to us. I mean, Asians or Mongoloid races, I mean, they're very different as well. But Hitler called them honorary Aryans, didn't he? The Japanese. That's
right. Yeah.
Because they had a civilization and they had a culture and they're interested in social justice and nationalism. They also had
Christians suffered down there as well.
Yeah, what was that? Wasn't Hiroshima the center of Christianity?
Yeah, of Christianity, that's right. Yeah, I think it was the second bombing. So the first kind of went out as the main one, but the second one's always overlooked as in anything in life, you know. So they quietly destroyed a lot of Christianity with the second bombing, as well as the first, but mainly the second one was the center of the ground zero of Christianity, really, in Japan.
Yeah, it was definitely a war against Christianity. Now, historian Jeffrey Herf writes, as a result of the discussions of spring and summer 1936, National Socialist officials had reassured Arab diplomats that National Socialist ideology and policy were directed against the Jews, not against non-Jewish Semites. National Socialism viewed Arabs and Muslims as different, but in clear contrast to the racial hierarchy presented in Mein Kampf, not as racially inferior. I would question that. You know, I mean, what Hitler is saying in Mein Kampf is that on specific things, there is obviously superior and inferior. You know, if you're looking at things like literature, you can say, well, the white race is obviously superior to a race that didn't have any literature. such as the Negro. That's not saying, though, that the white race is superior to all the others. That's saying that, that whites are superior in that area. You could just as easily say that Negroes are superior at the sprint than white people, or Negroes are superior at basketball than whites are. And again, it's because of biology that that's the reason for it. And it's because of biology that whites are superior in areas such as literature.
Swimming.
Yeah, and swimming. But they, you know, it's very disingenuous of Wikipedia to say this, that because the National Socialists said Arabs and Muslims are different rather than inferior. But, you know, I'm sure that Arabs and Muslims would say that they are superior in, I don't know, pattern creation. They're very, very good at patterns because they don't have artwork. They don't have images. But what they do have is very, very intricate geometric designs that they make. That's why they make such great carpets. There's nobody is better at making carpets than the people from the Middle East. And that's why, because they understand these geometric patterns, and they've been doing them for so long.
That's a fair point. Yeah, definitely a fair point. I mean, it did say some harsh things, Adolf, such as that nature is ruthless, and there's never been a better quote.
It's a falsehood to say that white nationalists or the National Socialists were all about this superior man that was going to subjugate the inferior man. You know, it was just about keeping the people separate as possible, and treating your guests with the courtesy and the honor that you would expect. You know, which you pointed out in the documentary, Dennis, with that runner, the black runner that won the Olympics, who was treated very, very, very well by Adolf Hitler, and
Jesse Owens.
What was it he said?
Well, he said, the press made out that he was snubbed by Hitler, but he kind of said in his autobiography, if anybody snubbed him, it was Roosevelt. He didn't even get asked back to the White House.
And a large part, actually, of the National Socialist propaganda against America was criticizing America for the way that it treated its blacks.
Yeah.
And they were against the Ku Klux Klan. They used that in their propaganda, as saying this is what America is about, and we would never be like that.
Correct.
So it's a falsehood, this supremacist idea. Continuing here, that as it was best that races not mix, non-Jewish Germans should marry other non-Jewish Germans. These abstruse discussions of the meaning of blood and race in summer 1936 offered a legal and conceptual foundation for reconciling German racial ideology and legislation with close and ongoing work with non-Jewish Semites, that is, Arabs and Muslims, before and during World War II. So the point of this was to say that you shouldn't mix, basically. Mm-hmm. If you want to have the strongest, healthiest nation, then you don't want the members of your nation to be interbreeding with any other peoples. If they interbreed with them, that they would lose their individuality that nation originally had.
That actually coincides with what Leon de Grel was talking about in the documentary, when he said that Hitler's racism was for all countries to rise with their own cultures and their own people, just like Germany had themselves.
That's how it's done. Because how are you going to have an individual nation with its individual character and its individual talents if that nation has mixed itself in with other nations? It's going to lose those talents. And it's not going to have a chance for them to grow. It's not going to have a chance for them to flower. And this is why we have all these different cultures for all the different nations in Europe.
And because that's why they want to destroy them.
Because they didn't interbreed with others, and over a period of time, they were able to grow into the shape that their individual racial soul dictated.
Well, all the sons and daughters of all these immigrants were thrown into Europe with Merkel, come on down, will grow up not exactly nationalistic to where they are, because they're not of that soil. And so when you're looking at a number of decades' time, there'll be a lost people in the middle of Europe, which is exactly what the elites wanted, and Kudinov-Kalergi.
They just want materialists, don't they? They want their identity to be dictated by whatever it is that they purchase, or by a football team, or by the music that they like. Anything to distract from actually having a real identity that's based on biology, based on history, based on the family tree that they have. The nation is just an extended family. It's the most obvious thing to unite around is the fact that it's an extended family of yours. I mean, it's just basic nature, isn't it? That should be the uniting factor of a nation, is the fact that everybody's related. Of course you're not going to be ripping one another off, because you're going to be looking at people as if that's your brother or your sister. Why would you want to treat them badly? I mean, it's a perfect starting point.
How boring would the world be if we were all coffee coloured and all the same? There'd just be no international culture to look at. Everything would be the same.
And don't forget, Kudinov Kalogi's plan was to have Jews at the top, the new aristocracy, running all of that. Everybody else coffee coloured and materialistic and at a low state of education, and then an aristocratic group of Jews running everything. And that was his plan.
That's exactly what he wrote,
Practical idealism. And that's why the Freemasons thought it was so great and funded him and pushed for it. And that's why the EU does what it does.
Which reminds me, by the way, Japan also got rid of Freemasonry.
Oh, Japan did?
Yeah.
I'm surprised they had much of a history of it there.
There was some there, yeah, but obviously Truman thought he'd get his revenge.
Was it expats or was it actually Japanese involved in it?
No, the lodges down there, they cleared them out. Yeah, just as they did in Germany, Italy.
Yeah, but were they Europeans that were in those lodges?
No, they were Japanese Freemasons. Right.
I know the blacks enjoyed Freemasonry once they were able to become part of Freemasonry. Yeah. They really took to it in America.
Mm.
Continuing here, they also learned that at least some Arab and Persian diplomats had no principled opposition to anti-Semitism, so long as it was only aimed at Jews, and even had become accustomed to thinking about peoples and nations in the racial categories emerging from the National Socialist regime. Well, there's 2 points there. So this shows you that there was opposition to the Jews. It wasn't something that was unique to the Germans. There was opposition to them amongst some of these Arabs and amongst some of these Persians. And of course, they become accustomed to thinking about people in racial categories because they're based on biology. They're based on common sense. They're based on what you can see and what you can measure. They're scientific. Mm-hmm. It's not mythic, the fact that there are racial differences. And it works. If you have science and you have a theory about something, and you test that theory to see whether it's true or false, and race theory and racial science, it is a science. It can be tested, and it proves itself to be true.
Nothing wrong with science. I mean, a lot of people think that people who are religious don't like science, but there's nothing wrong with science. It's just when it's pushed for certain agendas, which are never proven.
Oh, you wouldn't have science without the church. It was the church that funded it all. It was the church that funded all the education and taught everybody and encouraged science, because it's by learning all around the natural world around us that we learn to see the hand of God and understand the natural law and how everything works. And it all comes from looking around us and trying to get as best as we can at measuring it. And that's one way of looking at it. It's like when you look out into the universe, the better we are at seeing, the further you can see for, and the closer we are at looking and magnifying, the closer we get to understanding how germs work, and right down to bacteria and the smallest things, and learning all around the world around us. And it all comes from measuring and cataloguing and seeing patterns and seeing what creature resembles another creature and what it is about it that makes it similar, and coming up with categories for all these different creatures, categories like mammals and birds, and then within that, bears, whales, horses, canines.
It's just
why don't we do it for humans? We can't do it for humans, though. That's the madness. Yeah,
when they say I'm related to a monkey, I've got a problem.
Well, same here. Same here. The thing is, I mean, how can you look at all of that? How can you look at the world of biology and then say, oh, yes, but there's only one type of human, the human race? It just flies in the face of reality. So, of course, the racial categories of the National Socialist government were being used by these people because they worked. That's it with the Wikipedia quotes. And I've got some other quotes here about what happened with Iran and these other countries. The Shah of Iran was pro-Axis during World War II. And then we've got a quote here. The sound of German officers' footsteps was heard on the shores of the Nile. Swastika flags were flying from the outskirts of Moscow to the peaks of the Caucasus Mountains. Iranian patriots eagerly awaited the arrival of their old allies. I don't know, the outskirts of Moscow, that must have been just before the failure of Barbarossa.
Yeah.
That was written. The Iranian patriots were eagerly awaiting the arrival of their old allies. So they were waiting for them to make their way through, basically.
It just goes to show just how big a war World War II really was and what was at stake.
Well, Britain and the USSR and America forced their way into Iran, and the first thing they did was get the Shah to abdicate in favour of his son. So it's not like the people overthrew the Shah. The Allies overthrew the Shah and said, you're going to need to put your son in charge instead.
Yep.
And then later on, when we get to 1952, there was actually a National Socialist Workers' Party of Iran that was formed.
Amazing. Yep.
And this is interesting. After the 1953 Iranian coup d'etat, the National Socialist Workers' Party received a monthly stipend of 2,500 Iranian rial from the police and other security authorities. In 1958, Mon Shizadeh received $7,000 from SAVAK to go to the United States. The party was also possibly financed by foreign embassies based in Iran. In April 1952, Iranian police reported that Mon Shizadeh was seeking to establish ties with the British embassy to get financial support. It was allegedly funded by the CIA through TPBEDAMN. So as much as they claim to be against National Socialism now, they're not above funding National Socialist organisations in other countries that they want to destabilise. which you see happening in Ukraine. Yep. And this is what Putin alleges, that the neo-Nazis in the Ukraine are being funded by the West, and it's nothing new. The West were doing the same thing in Iran in 1953. And this coup d'etat, again, was the Allies, basically, removing the Prime Minister. There was a Prime Minister that was a nationalist, yep, and they kicked him out, basically.
And it set a precedent, didn't it, really, for the CIA all over the world?
Yeah, yeah. So that's Iran, and then you basically had this pan-Iran movement that's still going over there, and then you get to this football match that was a few years back where they're all doing the Roman salute, and they're all against Zionism, and this being against Zionism goes right the way back to this National Socialist era.
So which is probably why they have the Holocaust denial conference, where people from the West would go on and listen to the Iranians. And I think it was one of the top Iranians who was accused of saying that they're going to destroy Israel. He was totally misquoted. And he actually does deny that the Holocaust actually happened.
Ahmadinejad.
That's the one.
Yeah. And the revisionist conference, a lot of famous people were there, and that made international news. I mean, a big country like Iran saying the Holocaust it needs investigating. I mean, that's what they were basically saying is, why can't you investigate this? Well, we're going to have a conference and all the investigators can come here and we will try to get to the truth of exactly what happened. Because he was seeing it. His argument was that it was because of the alleged Holocaust that the Jews were allowed to kick the Palestinians out. I mean, the Balfour Agreement said that the Jews could move to Palestine and they could have a colony there. Mm-hmm. But it didn't say that they could kick the Palestinians out. They were supposed to be equal citizens with them. But after the war and after the Holocaust story came out in Nuremberg, the Jews felt emboldened to kick the Palestinians out. And any time it was pointed out, it was like, well, we've got to have our country to keep us safe from another Holocaust. And that was the excuse. Correct. So Ahmadinejad was saying, is that really true? Did the Holocaust really happen in the way that we are told? Were there really gas chambers? Were there really 6 million Jews that were killed? So that's what these conferences were about. But I think they stopped when Ahmadinejad stepped down. They haven't had any since then. I mean, maybe you saw that it probably wasn't too good a public relations exercise with the rest of the world to be
doing possibly that. But the point being, like, you know, is the truth doesn't fear investigation, and such a claim should be investigated to prove that they're right, and not to just throw anybody in prison for simple a denial of history.
They are still interested in it. I mean, Press TV has E. Michael Jones on quite a lot, mm-hmm. which is that's fantastic. But also there have been revisionist conferences, revisionist speeches, and there's been TV companies from the Lebanon that have been there filming it and talking about it on news reports. I mean, it is these Arab countries that actually cover what the revisionist historians and the revisionist scientists and scholars, what's actually going on there with the discoveries that they make, because it's not going to be covered in the Western press. Because they would just get accused of denial for actually printing up these results. But I say there are other countries as well that had this National Socialist influence. Syria is the first one. Mm-hmm. Baathism, the Baath Party, which has led Syria for decades, was heavily influenced by National Socialism. The Syrian Social Nationalist Party, formed by Anton Sada, which is second in popularity to the Baath Party, has a stylized swastika for the flag.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still in use today. So they're not seen as being enemies of the state or anything like that. They obviously form a part of it, because that is, you know, that's a recognized Syrian flag, is the stylized swastika that they have. And this Baath Party, that was Saddam Hussein's one as well.
Same one, and I heard that there was similar to National Socialism around about the time of the invasion when they were talking about the Baath Party,
And they had pan-Arabism as well. So they had the pan-Aryanism or the pan-Iranianism and also the pan-Arabism. I'm trying to think of the name, the Syrian Arab Republic, something like that. I mean, this pan-Arab nationalist movement, it's not as big as it used to be, but Syria used to be one of the countries that were leading it.
Well, I think a lot of the countries around Israel and the West Bank have been, America has taken down a lot of the governments.
You broke up a little bit there.
Possibly Jordan's another one. They're not wholly against Israel anymore because of these governments what have been put in place.
And you've got Egypt next. Otto Riemer was security advisor to Abdel Nasser, and Hans Ulrich Rudel and Otto Scorsini recruited SS and Gestapo officers to take posts in Nasser's regime.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got SS there that were advising Abdel Nasser on how to run the state, how to run the country. And this was after the war.
It doesn't get clearer than that, does it?
Well, and again, in Iraq, Saddam Hussein's uncle, Karila Tufa, was involved in the Iraqi revolt supported by Germany. Saddam Hussein and Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt, were close friends before either assumed power, and both were influenced by Baathism. So you've got these National Socialist influences that are all spreading out from Egypt and Syria and into Iraq. And I don't think it was down to this, you know, the anti-Jewish side of it. I think it was down to the social justice side of it. Because if you look at
positive side of it,
if you look at the way Syria is run, that they all the kids there are brought up in school to know their Syrian history. They're brought up to be nationalists. Bread is provided for everyone. Housing is provided for everyone. They make the Syrian people the center of everything, and you can't buy land in Syria if you're not Syrian. And I think to be a Syrian,
a big one, yeah.
Yeah, to be a Syrian citizen, you have to have Syrian grandparents as well as Syrian parents to say that you are Syrian, and they won't allow this dual citizenship at all.
No,
and
we shouldn't allow it.
No, and to be a Syrian politician, you have to be Syrian. You couldn't be in the government and not be.
And not be, yeah. Well, that's only right. I mean, you know, Syria is a country and it's all right. I'm not sure if Gaddafi's system was the same, but it certainly worked on the same lines of the people being the centre of it all.
Because Gaddafi was a lot later, wasn't he? So I don't think Gaddafi had... I mean, Gaddafi was a nationalist and he had some great ideas.
Yeah,
if you read his Green Book, and obviously those ideas worked. He was well-loved, but I'm not sure what influence he had from... National Socialism. No. And if you look at what they did with Egypt, you know, with the Arab Spring, and they overturned Egypt and turned it into, you know, the Islamic hellhole that it is now. They did the same with Iraq, and they tried to do the same to Syria. All these countries that had nationalist governments and were influenced by the National Socialists.
I've been rooted out, yeah.
And then Lebanon. And it says here, Hezbollah is infamous for its salute. Obviously, that salute must come from the Persian salute.
Yeah, the Romans, yeah.
Yeah, because they all do that, don't they? That's the actual Hezbollah salute. So of course,
yeah, there's history to it all, isn't it, which people don't really want to be knowing about, or so some politicians think.
Well, there's a lot there. I mean, it's a shame. I mean, I've been looking at this for the last hour or so, and then just before we went to air, I found a website that actually had loads of information about it that was actually written by an Iranian guy. And it would take quite a while to go through, but maybe we could have a look at that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the Germans had so much to do with the Iranians, that they were building all their railways and had that much influence that the country changed its name on the advice of the German ambassador...
It's amazing, isn't it?
You would think that there would be a lot of history there, a lot of interesting history that, you know, we just don't know about here in the West, especially with Iran being closed off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd like to see some of the pictures.
I saw an interview of the Shah who was ousted by the revolution in America. I think he had cancer at the time, and he was talking about the bankers and the Jews and how it, you know, affected the world. It was an interesting documentary. It used to be on YouTube. I'll have to see if we can find it.
Well, they're one of the few countries in the world that don't have a central bank that's linked up to the international banking system.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they don't have usury. I mean, the Islamic banks don't have usury, but they have another way of getting the money out of the people. But I'm not sure if the Iranian bank does.
No, but it's like, you know, they're always under pressure from either America or Israel, you know, threatening a war when Iran really haven't invaded anybody for 200 years.
Well, the other point is, I mean, one of the accusations that get made about Iran, they persecute Christians. And evangelical Christians will tell you that Christians are hanged in Iran. Yeah. But E. Michael Jones goes over there regularly to give speeches, and has debates with... Islamic scholars over there, so they can't just be hanging Christians. And as I say, he gets interviewed on Press TV. I think what it is you're not allowed to proselytize, so Christians aren't allowed to try and convert Muslims to Christianity, because they understand that would be subversive, because they are all Muslim. They don't want a subversive fifth column, and we shouldn't. You know, we should be the same in our Christian countries. We should not be allowing different religions in here.
Speaking of fifth columns, I wonder if there's a Freemasonry in Iran.
Yeah, you'll have to try and find that out, Dennis.
That would be interesting to find out.
Yeah, check that out, maybe in time for next week, because we're just about finished for this week, I think. So I say thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget that we do require your donations to keep Radio Albion going, and we do have a Bitcoin wallet, which you can find on every page at radioalbion.com. We'll be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.
Radio. radioalbion.com.